reiterate where we are. Starting at the top of the budget narrative form, the first thing that you have to begin the development of the governor's budget is the legislatively adopted budget, which is the budget at the end of session, and it includes the budget adopted by Ways and Means and any fiscal adjustments made as a result of policy bills or end of session adjustments. Moving to page two.
May I just add, we're using this budget simply as a sample.
It is.
This is apropos nothing. It's just a template.
Right. We did, Madam Chair, select this particular template because some of the issues that were raised will become apparent as we walk through this as well. Then, following the legislatively approved budget, there are adjustments that are captured through April 1, 2006. These adjustments include emergency board actions, any special session adjustments, and standard personnel actions. On April 1, a snapshot is taken of all planned and actual personnel actions and is referred to, you will hear people refer to this as the PICS freeze. And this is the point at which the personal services estimate is built into the system. This is the legislatively approved budget in orbits that you will see as the starting point. If you look at the budget narrative that we've handed out. Then there are adjustments that are made to come up with something called the base budget that you will see on this form. And this includes personnel actions and merit costs and base budget adjustments to debt service, non-limited funds, and capital construction. These adjustments become the starting point for calculating the essential budget level. The essential budget level is the calculation of the cost to provide the services approved in the legislatively approved budget. Generally speaking, the Ways and Means does not make adjustments to the essential budget level. Any adjustments that are made on a statewide basis. There may be decisions to reduce the state government service charge or other statewide adjustments. But it is generally not anything that the subcommittee would be dealing with. And those adjustments will probably be made in the end of the session, in an end-of-session omnibus bill. Now I'm going to walk you through the packages that are included in the essential budget level calculation. And I should step back and say these calculations are all identified and transmitted to agencies. All agencies use the same standard calculations for all of these adjustments. There's a very large book that is published that gives agencies directions on how to come up with these calculations. Starting with package 010, which is a calculation of vacancy factor. So if an agency has had a lot of turnover, there will be a reduction there to reflect the savings that come from losing personnel at a higher step and the time that positions are vacant. Package 020 is the phase in or phase out of programs of programs that have been approved or grants or other one-time costs that do not roll forward as part of the budget. Package 030 are inflation adjustments for the cost of goods and services and state government service charges. Package 040 is mandated caseload adjustments. Package 050 are fund shifts where perhaps funds are no longer available from one source, but the program will continue with general fund or some other fund source. And then package 060, which are technical adjustments. These adjustments comprise the essential budget level, which you see at the bottom of page one of this worksheet that we handed out. After the essential budget level is calculated, there are sometimes adjustments to that essential budget level, and what you have in the handout that we gave you, there is, in fact, a package 070 revenue reduction, generally with corresponding reductions in programs and staffing. And sometimes there will be a revenue reduction, and you will find a policy option package later that would restore that based on fee increases or some other action to generate the revenue. Package 080 is generally not used. It's a pretty specialized package. And package 090 are reduction options and other adjustments primarily made by the Department of Administrative Services in developing the governor's budget. And these adjustments sometimes are issues that will be brought to the subcommittee, will contain issues that will be brought to the subcommittee for subcommittee action because they are specific to the agency. So, for example, there may be a package 090 adjustment that was made in the governor's budget that Ways and Means does not want to happen, and so that change might occur in the agency budget. These three adjustments then comprise the modified essential budget level, which you see on the worksheet. And after that modified essential budget level is calculated, there may be additional adjustments in the agency budget to add programs and staffing or delete programs and staffing and services. And these adjustments are contained in policy option packages. Primarily, this subcommittee will be focusing on these policy option packages and recommending approval, denial, or modification to the full Ways and Means Committee. After the governor's budget is completed, and that's what you see at the very bottom, which is the 2007-09 budget, the Legislative Fiscal Office conducts an analysis of the governor's budget. And one of the ways that we try to make it as accurate and current as possible is that we go in and update the legislatively approved budget number as a comparison point through the December Emergency Board. This provides a more accurate comparison to the governor's budget. It doesn't affect the calculations or the ending point that you get to in the governor's budget. It is a point of comparison, and I wanted to make that clear.
Could I ask you to go through that very last part one more time?
Sure.
The comparison.
Yes. What we do is that we, LFO, compile all of the adjustments that have occurred to the budget between the April 1 cutoff, which is what you see here, and the December Emergency Board to reflect what is the actual expenditures or approved expenditures for that agency for the remainder of the biennium. And that is to give you a more accurate comparison between the legislatively approved budget, and the governor's recommended budget. For example, there was a salary adjustment that occurred after the April 1 date in all state agencies' budgets that were approved by the legislature that don't show up in the April 1 date. So by having that information as a comparison point, you have a more accurate index of growth. And I should put one final thing that I wanted to point out is that the budget actions taken between April and December are, in fact, factored into how the essential budget level is calculated. So it again, is just a comparative piece, not a change to any of the information. And that pretty much wraps up what I was going to cover. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions from Ms. Lamont? Thank you very much. I hope that, colleagues, this was helpful, and I will leave the door open to LFO if any of you have additional questions. I wanted this to occur in this setting so that we didn't have individual pilgrimages in taking time in legislative fiscal that they might not have.
I will echo, Madam Chair, that we are happy to sit down with any of you at any time to go over any detail that you have. So, and welcome the opportunity. So,
thank you very much.
One other thing before I leave, I did hand out a 2-week tentative schedule for the subcommittee. It's two-sided, so both this week and next week. Tentative schedule for the subcommittee, just for the subcommittee's information.
Thank you very much. Ms. Deister, any comments before we begin on any other of the materials that were distributed at the members' places?
You will find at your places, Madam Chair and committee members, an overview memo of OLCC, things that you might want to be aware of as they're making their presentation. What I've attempted to point out here is that the major issue that OLCC has been dealing with over the course of the interim has to do with growth, both in the number of licensees and in the amount of sales. They did make a couple of trips to the emergency board over this past interim, both for the purposes of additional expenditure limitation to accommodate to accommodate additional growth over and above what they originally projected. That occurred twice, actually. They've had a very good biennium in terms of gross sales. And also, they sought additional expenditure limitation for the purchase of a warehouse facility. And that purchase has basically obviated the need for leased warehouse space going forward, and will allow them to not have to make additional modifications to their distribution facility as a short-term fix while they were trying to find better facilities to meet the amount of product that's coming in and leaving. So I think an important thing to point out with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is that a large percentage of their expenditure limitation is devoted to payment of what's called agent's compensation, and that's roughly about 61% of their expenditure limitation. Basically, agents are compensated at a rate of 8.8% of average sales. So those are dollars that go, for practical intents and purposes, are a lot like pass-through, but they are limited by this body, by the Waste Management Board. So that 8.88 is an average. It's set by statute. And there was a budget note requesting an interim study and that of the agent's compensation rate, and that should be finished and available in June.
I'm sure we'll hear more about that from Mr. Farrow. So with that, anything else, Ms. Deister? Okay.
No.
With that, Mr. Farrow and Mr. Padja, are you going to join him up here? Great. Okay. Welcome, gentlemen. Anybody else coming up from your team, Mr. Farrow?
There will be. Madam Chair, there will be.
Okay. They all want to snuggle up right from the beginning. That would be fine.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Steve Farrow, Director of the OLCC.
Let's just do microphone check. That seems an awfully long way away, so if you draw the mic towards you, that would be perfect. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Steve Farrow, Director of the OLCC, and I have some of my staff here with me. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Michael O'Connor. I'm the Director of Financial Services for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Linda Ignowski, the Enforcement and Field Operations Director.
And Ms. Ignowski, I'm going to ask you to spell your last name for the benefit of the staff.
It's Ignowski.
Thank you very much. Mr. Farrow.
Madam Chair and committee members, I certainly want to thank the LFO for sort of setting the tone for what we're going to have, I think, as a steady theme through what we're going to talk about, and that's growth. Continuing demand for both services and products is accelerating at a really sharp rate. And I'm going to go ahead and ask you to turn to tab under drivers. It's key budget drivers and the issues associated with that. I'm sorry.
In the presentation book, the budget information book.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, the growth has been exceptional. The public safety component has been very much stressed, going ahead to try and keep up with all the interests that want to see responsible sales and service for the community, your city. There's moderation groups, neighborhood associations, healthcare providers. All of them have a very strong interest in seeing us do what we do. We have been working very hard at that, but with the growth that we're experiencing, we are finding it much more difficult to go ahead and stay on task and up where we need to be. The economic development is just as important to us. There's a strong growth that has taken place throughout the state. There are those that want to buy the product, sell the product, operate the liquor stores, wholesale and distribute beer, make distilled spirits, and do the manufacturing. Many of those things are driven by the population increase within the state. So when you have more people, you have more tourism, more people want to drink, more licensees want to go ahead and create that opportunity to service those tourists. Therefore, you have more licenses and more licensees that need to be taken a look at, need to be worked with, need to be help them understand what needs to be done in terms of enforcing and following our liquor laws. Oregon's growing population, as well as the tourism increase, has really pushed this process along considerably. Over the last 10 years, Oregon's population has grown by more than 11%. To feed that population demand in terms of distilled spirits, once you consider the fact that in the last 10 years, sales of product, case sales, have gone from 1.5 million to 2.3 million. That's 800,000 cases more per year than what we used to do. Now, I want to give you some context on that. You get about 1,200 cases on a 50-foot trailer. So if you can imagine the difference from one year to the next of about 600 to 650 50-foot trailers end-to-end filled with distilled spirits. That's how strong the growth has been. Well, that growth, that demand, certainly creates opportunities for Oregon's economic development. That economic development may lead to the opportunities for new restaurants, taverns, manufacturers. We've had several small distilleries start up in order to meet that need. Between the fiscal years 1990 and 2005, we experienced a 55% increase in the number of licensed businesses.
Mr. Farrow, just for the general edification of the committee, if I were going to start a restaurant tomorrow, what points of contact do I have with you? I've got my brand-new empty building, and I want to sell beer, wine, and distilled spirits. What are my points of contact with your agency?
Madam Chair, you would start with an application process that you could find either on the application is online, or you come into one of the field offices or the main office, and they would provide you the paperwork that you would need to get started on that. You would also have to, after you complete your application, submit it to us, would have to go to local government to get an endorsement from them or a recommendation from them. From there, it depends on the history, kind of depends on your establishment. If it goes through as just a grant from field staff, or it needs to move up to the commissioners or the director for a decision to be made on issuing your license.
And what things are you going to be looking at from me in terms of my background, my wait staff, how quickly they're trained, those sorts of questions?
Madam Chair, the initial application we look at is we look at you as a licensee. We look at your criminal background. We look at if you have a habit of abuse of alcohol or drugs. We look at the premises itself, see if you're buying one that's already existing that's had problems in the past. We look at a variety of different criteria that's set out by statute to see if you qualify for a license. And then from there, we would issue the license. Secondary would be if you have a restaurant, your staff would have to have a service permit. And so we would eventually check on, make sure that your staff has service permits.
And how much time has elapsed? Because as a business person, for me, time is money. And I've got my restaurant all ready to go. I just need to open the doors. And in order to be successful, I need all of the okie-dokies from you. So from the time I've downloaded your application off the Internet to the time I'm serving my first margaritas, how long has that been?
Madam Chair, it varies across the state. If you were opening up in the metro area, unfortunately, you would be looking at, and that's one of our budget packages, is about 100 to 110 days before we would finish our process. Out in the field, it may be a little sooner, dependent upon the workload in the field.
And just to give you forewarning, one of the questions I'm going to ask you about is, what are your agency plans to speed that up? Cool.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just wanted to give the committee a sense of industry, the hospitality industry's interaction with you.
Madam Chair, committee members, since we brought up the point, at this time, we have almost 12,000 active licenses out there. We have, to give you some perspective, 32 field inspectors that need to be going around and checking and working with each of those licensees. So you can just do some of the math and see how many places that we need to be at one time. Along with the population growth, there's also an increase in diversity for the state. Along with that increase in growth also comes some of the pressures that come from that are minors in possession of alcohol. One of the major issues we have is dealing with the minors in possession. Minor alcohol consumption is linked to a number of ills for the teens. Drink rates are up for Oregon teens in the 8th and 11th grades. These trends affect the OLCC as an organization and has a major role in preventing these minors to get the liquor. Growing concerns to protect the public from irresponsible sales of alcohol, both to visibly intoxicated and minors, is growing, and we feel very strongly there is a need to answer that. A new generation of alcohol consumers has come into the marketplace. There is growth in both the opportunity presented by the diverse alcohol that is presented in terms of the drinks. There is also a huge challenge for the commission to stay up with the licensing of all these business opportunities that are given. But in staying up with those licensing opportunities, we must very seriously look at the public safety involved to make sure that minors are not in possession and that everyone who has a license is following the rules and the laws.
Senator Berger.
Yes, but isn't it true that a lot of the alcohol that is purchased for minors is purchased by their parents or by an older adult?
Sure, Senator Berger. Our studies show that a large majority is provided by either a parent or an older person, but there also is percentage that is purchased from licensed premises, too.
Is that responsive, Senator?
Well, it's not what I know to be true in my area, and we've had that problem in my district, and so I bow to your knowledge, but one of the things that we have been fighting in my district is the fact that parents have parties, parents buy the alcohol, parents furnish it, and then kids drive the cars, and so there's a public safety problem. But it's really not the liquor stores that are selling to minors and not carding them, and because we have had such a problem with minors drinking, so we have really focused on it. And that is not where the problem lies. It's in the delinquent adults.
Madam Chair, Senator Berger, that is true in a lot of different places. What I was also looking at is our minor decoy operations that we do throughout the state. We still only have a 70, I think currently we have a 76% compliance rate. So that means about one out of four times a person, as a young person, can purchase alcohol from a licensed premises. So that's one gauge that we gauge, is that if we had 100% compliance, then we know they're not getting from licensed premises. But as we do our minor decoy operations throughout the state, we're still ranging between 72 to 76% compliance rate. So there's still places where young people and minors can get alcohol. So both places absolutely have an issue for us.
Yes, on this same subject, I spent 21 years as a high school teacher. My experience was that with hard liquor, that often the teenagers would go home after school and mom and dad aren't there and raid the liquor cabinet. So even though they were being, quote, supplied by their parents, maybe it was not with permission or so on, that sometimes happened. But it's also, I think there's also evidence that the Green Front stores are really doing a pretty good job of checking ID and not selling to minors, but that it's the little A&P stores that sell a lot of beer and cigarettes where most of the problem is. And then I hear or I read that there's a new products that are out that are twice the alcohol content of beer, that are basically sweetened like pop drinks, but they have a lot of zip to them, that clearly are marketing kids, underage people. And I just wondered, and that those products are sold in grocery stores, not in Green Front stores, so that they're a lot easier to access than the hard liquor, which is controlled through the Green Front stores. Can you comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, there is a proliferation of products that are geared towards young people. There's one just recently that we became aware of, and I've actually found samples throughout the stores in Portland, Eugene, and in Bend. It's called Spikes. I don't know if you've ever seen this. It's a little jar, and I'll bring one tomorrow so you can see when I have some.
Bring enough for the whole committee, please.
I didn't mean to string. they're little. They look like a nail polish bottle. There are flavors that were made by Anheuser-Busch to supposedly add flavors to beer. One of them is chocolate, one of them is mango, one's melon, and one's a lime base. And or you can drink it by itself as a shot. It's 12% alcohol, and it's malt based, so it isn't sold in a liquor store. It is sold at, and right now we're finding it at 7-Elevens, Plaid Pantries, all the, not Plaid Pantries, but your small convenience stores. So if you go buy one, they're right now sitting at the counters in these little display things. We're going to take a serious look at that. The commission does have the ability to refuse some products that are geared towards minors, and we may be looking at this one. But absolutely, the liquor agents are being very good about checking for ID and making sure that minors aren't getting alcohol. Once in a while, there's a slip-up. The one thing that we're finding at liquor stores is furnishing. It's where kids are sitting outside the store waiting for an adult to come by and asking them if they'll purchase something for them in the liquor store. And that's one area that we're working on a program to try to stop that, because that's very detrimental too. So they're getting it in a lot of varieties of ways. And there's the Liquor Commission can't solve all of it, but we can try to prevent some of it from coming from licensed premises and our agents.
I have two administrators. Go ahead.
No, at some point, I'd like an answer to this question, not necessarily now. There have been attempts, seems like every session, to scrap OLCC and go to the California system, where the booze is right next to the baby food in the grocery stores. At some point, I would like you to explain to us why that's not a good idea.
I have two administrative comments, and I got quite a queue waiting to speak. The two administrative comments are that we need to get through this budget with enough time to leave public comment tomorrow. We're going to do this budget for 2 days, and I think that there's some pent-up desire for some public comment. I want to leave time. The second thing is for those younger people who are listening on the Internet, or for some of our younger colleagues who may have no idea what a green front is, and Senator Monroe has dated himself and some of the rest of us, that would be a liquor store. So we'll start with Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you don't need to deal with it today, but I'm very interested in the education component of this, how we educate children and adults about the dangers of especially young children drinking.
I have one more administrative item. This is also a budget committee, and while getting into the policy of OLCC is extraordinarily tempting, what we're going to be doing is their budget. With that, Senator George.
Well, now I don't want to ask the question.
You get a free shot
today.
Quickly,
really quickly, page 7, page 6, refers to the new generation prefers distilled spirits. Right in the middle of that page on page 6, it refers to 8th grade girls. In a period of 4 years, there was an 8.2% increase in the consumption of hard liquor. Do we have any idea what's happening?
Madam Chair, Senator George, it really isn't geared towards hard liquor. It's alcohol in general. And this is taken from the Department of Human Services study, the teen survey they do every year with children. And they survey them, asking if they have consumed alcohol within the last 30 days. And in the last, from 2001 to 2004, they have seen an 8.2% increase in those responses saying, yes, I've had alcohol. And that's alarming when you have eighth graders saying they've had alcohol in the last 30 days.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Following up on Senator Monroe's line of questioning, there are products out there, mouthwash products, that have as much as 21.53% alcohol, I believe. I mean, for goodness sakes, that's 43 proof. And the kids are drinking that stuff. And it's not just, you know, it's like the typical Listerine, but they also have products that have the orange, and they have the yellow, and they have the blue, and they have the red. The kids call it Kool-Aid. So I wonder, is OLCC looking at that problem, and what are you planning to do with it? You don't need to answer that right now.
Madam Chair, Senator Woods, unfortunately, we don't. We only regulate beverages, those that can be consumed. And pharmaceuticals are not part of the regulations that we cover. So the alcohol that we are regulating, that's what is consumed, is considered potable, so you can consume it. Mouthwash is supposedly not to be swallowed or drank.
It's great if you mix it with Coke.
Okay. You still make a label.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Follow-up, Senator Whitson.
Yeah, I take it from that response that you have either no authority or no intention of doing anything about it, or even working with the agencies that do.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, we do not have the authority, but we would be happy if it pleases the committee to talk with whatever agency that is working that. If there is anybody else that's working it. Because it's not in our authority to.
I'm going to ask the professional staff to just flag that as something that we may come back to in the work session. So with that, Mr. Farrell, continue. We have about an hour left.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, one thing I would like to follow up on. There's been a lot of talk about the different products that come out there that are very attractive to the youth. And I do want to mention, though, that the companies will work with us. The distilled spirits company, there was one company that produced a vodka that actually stained your mouth. So the younger folks could go ahead. Some of it was yellow, some of it was blue, some of it was red. So we certainly identify that as a real threat in terms of being primarily youth-driven, and the company was responsive and did take that off the marketplace. So I do want to go ahead and say sometimes their ideas perhaps are not that good, but they will work with us if we approach them on some of those things. Just to summarize with regards to key budget, we talked an awful lot about here about the growth, about the issues that are out there. There's no doubt that we cannot alone solve minors drinking. That has to be a whole we'll look at that in terms of family, in terms of the OLCC and many other sources that contribute. But we are looking to go ahead and improve our public safety and support economic development at the same time. However, we need to balance those needs, and those needs must be reinvested in. So by reinvesting in the inspectors and adding inspectors to the marketplace out there gives us ability to look closer at some of those kid drinks that might be coming onto the marketplace and keep an eye on those things, as well as work with licensees so that we can improve their compliance. We seek to build and strengthen collaborative relationships, streamline and simplify processes, look for technological solutions wherever possible, and gain resources to go ahead and meet the needs that confront us with regards to those key budget drivers.
Mr. Farrell, given that one of your policy option packages is going to ask for additional staff resources, how would you characterize your relationship between your field folks and the licensees that they oversee? Is it collaborative? Is it working together? Is it more a regulatory gotcha kind of relationship? Describe it, if you would.
Madam Chair, I think it's a little of everything, and it kind of depends on what side you're on. We are trying very hard to be more on the compliance side, and I make a distinction between compliance and enforcement. To me, in compliance billing, you're trying to help licensees gain compliance by helping them understand the law and so they can stay within the law and doing some education and training. There's enforcement when those who don't get the message who continue to break the laws that we do take administrative action against them. There are several violations that we've always held that there isn't any second chance. We call them priority violations, and they're selling to minors and selling to visibly intoxicated persons. If you get a violation for those, we usually will cite those because we feel those are huge public safety issues. We work when we can with the communities, with the licensees, and dealing with them. But we are a regulatory agency, and I'm trying very hard with my staff to try to find the balance between helping building compliance with the licensees and doing the right thing and enforcing the law, because there's a special balance. If you never write a citation and you never find anybody doing anything wrong, then our rules are just basically worthless. And so there has to be a balance of, and there's a reason why we have these laws. A lot of them are set by statute, and a lot of them by rules. And so we're trying to find that balance. It kind of depends on who you're talking to about our relationship with them as an enforcement staff.
Madam Chair, I'd like to also comment on that. We are working very hard to reach out to licensees in particular. The director of licensing is going out and meeting with licensees that we've started that. The distilled spirits director will also be going out and meeting with licensees. We have our stakeholder meetings where we have both policy and the business leaders in. So we are reaching out to go ahead and bridge some of the communications gaps that we have perhaps had in the past. That will start a dialogue that will help each side better understand the compliance issues and the challenges that confront both of us. So we are reaching out more than what we have in the past.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions on the key drivers, then I would like to go ahead and refer to the results tab. The OLCC is currently tracking 10 of 12 key performance measures. And what I might point out is that if you want to see those measures in particular, they are in the back of the book, in the annex back there. The pages will be, we've had a little bit of a problem, we might be off by a page number or two, but basically you can go to the annex and look for the performance measurements, and you can find those back there if you want to see the individual performance criteria. The first one I'm going to comment on is licensee contacts. We had a target of 25. We've achieved that pretty much almost to the point where we were coming up exceeding the 33. We are raising that target to 37. Obviously, the more contact we can make, the more important it is to help the licensees understand some of the issues. Although I might point out with 12,000 licenses out there, some of them may not be as qualitative as we would like. So if you're trying to make the contacts, you need to get in and get out. We would like to, of course, we have a package in asking for additional inspectors. We would like to increase the qualitative as much as possible, as well as just the contacts.
Where are those inspectors headquartered? I mean, are they dispersed all over the state, or are you sending them all out from Salem when they go?
Madam Chair, community members, we have the primary offices in Portland, but we also have Salem, Medford, Bend, Pendleton, and we're looking at opening one in Ontario.
Madam Chair, we have 11 sites throughout the state, as far north as Portland, as far north, and we have 11. We have one in Normal, Portland, Warrington, Salem, Eugene, Roseburg, Newport, Medford, Coos Bay, Klamath Falls, Bend, and Pendleton. We have a few satellite offices, and I call them satellite offices because we have a cooperative agreement with law enforcement. They've housed one of our inspectors to get them closer to the community, and those are in Corvallis, Hillsborough, Cornelius, and then Hood River.
The next performance measure would be sales to minors. Our target was 70. We were hitting that and exceeding that. So for 2006, we have raised that to 73%.
Product Senator Whitsitt, you look quizzical.
Why would you? Yes, yes, Senator. Thank you. Why would we have a? Why would we have a performance measure of 73% for something that's illegal?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we're measuring those that comply with not furnishing. So the 73%.
I understand that. That means you're condoning 27% of the illegal activity?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we're not condoning any of the activity, but we obviously seek to go ahead and have as high a compliance rate as possible. That's what we're working toward.
Follow-up, Senator Whitsitt.
Wouldn't a target of 100% be more appropriate then?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, certainly we would love to hit 100%. If the, in all honesty, if the target is so far out there, sometimes it begins to be difficult to go ahead and measure performance against that, because it we've got a long ways to go in ensuring that the sales to minors are at 100%. So the 73%, we try and hit it as far as achievable or stretch ourselves to those numbers. But at this point, going to 100, we certainly could do that, although it would be unlikely that we would hit that anytime soon.
This committee will have the opportunity to actually make that adjustment if the committee desires.
Thank you.
The next performance measure will be product availability. We have consistently exceeded the 99%. It's absolutely imperative. The marketplace now is between 1,300 and 1,500 items that we carry. The dollar production and public satisfaction is demanded to have a high performance number like this, and we continually exceed the 99%, which is pretty exceptional. The next one is profit margin.
I think you skipped agent evaluations.
Madam Chair, agent evaluations, let me go ahead and refer back to that.
I'm just going off your list on page one of results.
Madam Chair, you're correct. Although what I was going to refer to, agent evaluations, a little later on, because we have changed those agent evaluation standards a couple of times, we were looking for some time before we actually anchor back in to see that we were hitting these numbers. So if we're moving those standards around, it is difficult to go ahead and actually get an accurate measurement.
Okay, I just have one question. If this is one of your articulated performance measures, are you tracking how you're performing against it? Because it would be up to this panel to make an adjustment in that performance measure.
Madam Chair, we are tracking. The target has been 30%. We are tracking at 28%.
And one other question. Do you have any mechanism for reciprocity so that you get a cross-section of customer satisfaction with your agents, who are also your customers, and their satisfaction with the agency? Do you have a way to track that back and forth?
Madam Chair, when it comes to comment, the agent can comment to the evaluator with regards to the evaluation that is being conducted. So there is a mechanism for them to comment on that.
Cool. Okay.
Okay. Next one was profit margin. We have consistently been running. We are targeted between 38 and 39%, and we have consistently been running in that range. Staff training. Target has been 50%. We have exceeded that. We were running at 88%. Case handling, those are the cases that are shipped on a daily basis by distribution staff from the distribution center. We have been exceeding that target. We will be looking at, with the addition of the additional warehouse, we will be looking at perhaps modifying this number. License processing time. As Director Ignowski commented on, we currently are running around 110 days. Our target is between 90 and 120. We have been consistently running within that range, although it is our sincere hope to, along with the one of the packages we have, to add a couple license investigators and therefore improve that. Violations versus contact. The target has been 45 and we achieved 33. Regional minor decoy. Target has been 73%. And we have been on average around 72. I'm sorry. Been in Portland, have achieved 74. We do have slightly less than that for Eugene, Medford, and Salem. Inventory turnover, that's the number of times that OLCC's inventory turns over. We have been running about 11.6 turns. Our numbers, we want to end up between 10 to 11. Then we already commented on agent evaluation. Then there's a customer service. And we are currently working through that. You can see the performance as far as the numbers for customer service. One of the things that I commented on earlier, and that's the communications, where we really want to try and pick up, and that's where if any numbers have been lacking with regards to customer service, that's where we want to continue to improve.
Time for question.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, minor decoy. Does the minor decoy program include the Green Front stores, or is that just purveyors of wine and beer?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, yes, it does include. All of our state contracted agencies are included in that.
So your 72% compliance rate includes those? It includes the liquor stores as well as the beer and wine
Madam
distributors?
Chair, Senator Monroe, that's correct.
Do you have a breakdown between the two? What's the compliance rate for the liquor stores, and what's the compliance rate for others?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, we can get that for you. I do not have that available at this time.
Thank you. I think it's a very important number.
Representative Tillman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Number seven, customer service. Who is the customer that you're referring to there?
Madam Chair, Representative Tillman, the customer that we're referring to is the general public at that point.
Follow. Either going to the liquor store or to a tavern or a bar, is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, that's how I understand it, yes.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm jumping way ahead here, but I want to ask a question because I need to have an answer. I'm looking here in the budget where it's talking about malt liquor and wine, and the total projected revenue is about $31 million. We were given a number in revenue of a net of about $14 million, about $7 million each, beer and wine. Is that the difference? Is that the amount that doesn't make it through to the general fund?
Madam Chair, Senator George, that's correct. The Oregon statute required that 50% of privileged taxes that are collected, well, actually, if I could, the first 2 cents of every gallon of wine tax collected goes to the Oregon Wine Board. The remainder then is split 50-50, with half going to the mental health and drug and alcohol treatment account, and the balance going back into our cash pool, which is then distributed out based on statute.
Follow up, Senator George.
That's it.
That's it?
Thanks.
Cool. Representative Hinn.
Thank you. Just someone else's comment on this issue, but I find it striking that as we look through these key performance measures, when earlier we read that alcohol is a major contributing factor in the four leading causes of death for teens, highway crashes, homicide, suicide, and drowning. Minor alcohol consumption is also linked to other crimes such as sexual assault, vandalism, excessive noise, littering, and public urination. We've also heard that the sales of alcohol is going up pretty steep. And the agency that oversees it has what appears to be one key performance measure that measure sales to alcohol, that they've increased the target by 3%. I just think we ought to take a hard look at that. If we got all these ills tied to it, and we have all these other business measurements, I mean, we got business measurements here, and I understand those, and I think that's a good idea. But we got some more critical stuff happening that aren't being measured, and I think we ought to consider that.
I will ask the professional staff to flag that as something we'll visit again when we work the budget.
Madam Chair, committee members, I would now refer you to the tab that is, it says priorities and 10%. The first document you'll run into, I hope you take a few moments to read when you get an opportunity, and that's our new draft of our strategic plan. It really is very pivotal in terms of seeing the agency as one unified system in balance and equilibrium.
Mr. Farrow, just so we can understand, was this strategic plan created as an in-house document, or did you use advisory groups to help build this strategic plan? Were there others at the table with you when this was built?
Madam Chair, committee members, we have, through our stakeholder meetings, great opportunity to hear from business and policy folks. When we were sitting down creating this document, it was primarily driven, though, in-house, but with certainly with information that is available through our meetings with the stakeholders.
Okay, please continue.
Now I would go to page one behind the strategic plan. And basically, we've already touched upon it very strongly, where the key drivers, and that's what we do. Public safety services program is number one for us. We assure through education and enforcement, we reduce minors' access to alcohol, reduce licensees over service, minimize negative alcohol-related impacts on neighborhood livability, administer a sober education program, assure due process once there is an issue with one of the licensees, and coordinate administrative rulemaking functions.
I do want to tag that server education. That was something that you and I talked about when you came to visit my office, and it has been raised to me as a customer satisfaction issue, so I'd like to tag that and come back to it in when we work the budget.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I
Senator
add something to that? There was a program, and if you took some training and happened to make a mistake, that you weren't penalized the first time. Is that still in effect with OLCC?
Madam Chair, Senator Berger, I think you're referring to the Responsible Vendor Program.
That's right.
And it wasn't that they got a free bite of the apple. They got a reduced sanction for the first sale if they were members of the Responsible Vendor Program. And so they have a significant reduction, and they have a separate sanction schedule if they were, and it's only for sale to minors.
Right.
It's not for any other violations.
I'm going to ask you to provide us some additional data on that, because I know that in sessions gone by when I've had the opportunity to be involved with this budget, there were quite a few public comments with respect to grocery clerks and the degree of sanctions that were exercised against grocery clerks, and a one mistake and you're out kind of mentality that had been displayed by the regulatory side of your agency. And if you could give the whole committee some additional info on that, that would be very helpful. I don't want to take time to do it today, but I just would like to know what the status of that is. Susan Hannah, do you have a question?
Yes, okay. That's it.
Representative Filmmaker.
Just to clarify, I would assume it's not just the server, but whoever hires the server also. I would assume that there are some sanctions against the owner or employer. Is that true?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, yes. The licensee is always sanctioned for the acts of their employees, and so there is, like, for a server in a restaurant, the server committee would get us administrative sanction, and so would the licensee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Gilman, I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're doing this study on sales through a state system like ours compared to California,
Could you also, if you can find information on sales to minors in those states, it would be very helpful.
Senator George.
This is budget related. How far do we go in making sure that the person who is going to be qualified to sell is in fact an honorable person? In other words, you do criminal backgrounds. Can you describe how extensive that is? Would it be the same as a person getting a concealed carry, for example, where you do an FBI?
Madam Chair, Senator George, I'm not familiar with the background of a concealed weapon. We do alleged search law enforcement database system on them for Oregon only. We are we're hindered somewhat of looking outside of Oregon's for criminal background unless we have some other indication. And so we can only look at the Oregon background that they have, but we do look at their qualifications based on criminal background. If law enforcement, like a lot of your cities, do background checks too, and sometimes they come up with more information, and then we can use that to do further investigation. So we try to do as thorough as we can and trying to find out if this is a suitable person that qualifies for a license.
Follow-up, Senator George.
Are you prohibited by statute to go ahead and, say, run the FBI through state police, run the FBI back to background?
Madam Chair, Senator George, it's really... as far as I can tell, it's kind of a difference between the philosophy of the state police and the ability for us to use the LEDs because of they see it, the LED system used for enforcement, and they see licensing as different. And so there's a philosophical difference between state police and us on the ability to use their system for licensing.
That's interesting. That may be something that the legislature would want to come back and revisit. Mr. Farrell?
The distilled spirits program, basically, it's pretty clear-cut. We receive, we ship.
Would you help us? What page are we on?
I'm sorry. That'd be page 2. That'd be right behind the prioritized OLCC program of services. We do the wholesale. We receive, store, ship. We work through our 241 to 243 contract agents out there. We depend upon them to do the retail for us. They manage and safeguard the state-owned inventory. They do the sales revenue for the state. We use the technology and other strategies in order to improve the system wherever we can. There has been tremendous growth there, and there's been a lot of challenges, but we have stepped up to the plate and done very well in that program.
I want to come back to the customer survey for just a second. Are any of your vendors included in your customer survey?
Adam.
If I'm a distiller, how's my product treated when it comes in the warehouse? What's the breakage? What's...
Madam Chair, to your answer, there is no inclusion with regards to distillers per se. We do have access to the stakeholders, but we do not necessarily sit down with them individually or send them out a form for them to fill out.
One last thing, and I'm going to stop interrupting you. You refer repeatedly to your stakeholders. Could you provide to the professional staff so they can disperse to the panel who you consider your stakeholders, what advisory committees you have, who those people are, and what their relationship with the agency is? For example, if you have a vintner on an advisory board, I'd like to have him identified as a vintner.
Madam Chair, we'll get that for you.
Great, thanks.
Third is the support services program. The support services program basically says what it does. It takes care of the leadership, oversight, and daily management of the organization, supports the public safety and distilled spirits program. It's got the responsibility for the accounting and financial services, information technology, public relations, human resources, and auditing liquor taxes. Next, we would have the store operating expenses. Those are the monies that are at 8.88% paid to our contract retail agents out there in order to compensate them for all their services. It pays their expenses for operating the agent-operated liquor store. It includes all their operating expenses, everything they have to pay for their employees, lights, etc. And lastly would be the capital improvement, and of course capital improvement is to cover the OLCC owned facilities, which will soon be included, will be an extra warehouse that we have for our product.
When you acquire an extra warehouse and there are costs associated with that, are there additional costs then to the agents? Do you assess any cost against them, for example, if they have to have a different computing relationship to talk to a new warehouse? Do you calculate those additional costs to the agents in any way?
Madam Chair, there is no additional cost to the agents for this service.
Cool. Thanks. Representative Tomei.
Since your warehouse is currently in my district, I'm wondering where the new warehouse will be.
Madam Chair.
I'll shoot you if he tells you.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, it'll be actually about, I'd say, 200 yards from the current facility. I'm going to get a little excited here. It couldn't be better. Couldn't be better. I mean, when it's that close, it's 104,000 square feet. We anticipate it would cover us probably between 10 and 15 years with the growth. There'll be minimal things that we have to do to the warehouse, but it will do would do tremendous things for us in order to go ahead and get the product in. I'm also going to spout off a little bit, so excuse me for getting carried away here. We have about 1,300 to 1,400 regular items. We worked very closely with the industry and the agents to go ahead and make sure that we had enough product in this year. We used the lease space. Of course, in the future, we'll use the additional warehouse space. And of those 1,400 products, we had 16 products we didn't have available. Of those 16 products, 9 of those were not available from the companies because they didn't have any stock. Of the remaining products, they hardly sell at all. So that's why I'm excited about getting a new warehouse there.
We'll do a follow-up with Representative Tomei, then Representative Edwards.
I'm still unclear. Where is it? East, west of the...
I'm sorry. If you're familiar with going down the street that comes along McLaughlin, mm-hmm. head up the hill. It's right at the top of the hill.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the approximate net savings given the new warehouse versus leasing?
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, we haven't done a specific study. We had actually asked in our initial agency request budget to have a study done by DAS, but because this was rather serendipitous, when we project out, the total cost of the warehouse is $5.7 million, and lasting us for 10 to 15 years, from a cash flow standpoint, it made sense. It's about 1 week worth of cash flow for the Liquor Control Commission. Madam Chair, if I may, and Representative Edwards, we also had included in our original agency request budget additional funds for leasing space across the street, renting space across the street from a public warehouse that we're not going to be incurring additional costs for as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. I would like to see the lease figures in terms of the projected cost of leasing, just so I can get a sense of the net savings over time. Taking into account the depreciation schedule for the new warehouse space.
And I'm just going to renew the request that all of the questions be handled through the professional staff, and they'll disseminate the answers to everybody. Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, committee members, suffice to say our top priority is without question protection of the public safety by making alcohol available in a socially responsible manner. Number one priority. At this time, I would like to refer you to the tab that has packages, and this is our policy option packages. And I'm going to ask Director Ignowski to speak to policy package number 202.
Mr. Crow, just by way of the display, is this all of them, or have you broken them down by program area? Is this the totality of your policy option packages?
Madam Chair, it is.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Linda Kowalski, the Field Enforcement and Field Operations Director for the Commission, and I'm pleased to be able to provide you an opportunity for a brief summary of our policy option packages. So I would more than entertain any detailed information, but try to give you an overview. I will be doing package 202, 203, and 304 today. Policy Option Package 202 is the major components is asking for additional 5 inspectors or liquor regulatory specialists throughout the state and 3 half-time support staff for the small support offices across the state to help the liquor regulatory specialists in those areas. The reason we're asking for this, and I'll give you some little bit of background, and I have a lot of passion for this, back in, and Liquor Commission was created in 1933 for the Liquor Control Act, and they were given the responsibility to regulate the manufacture and distribution, sale and service and consumption of alcohol beverage in our state. And the purpose for that was to safeguard our state from ever going back to the pre-prohibition era. And thank goodness I was not part of that. But and also, to, and it's done a really good job. Our rules and our laws have done a really good job, so we haven't returned to the issues of pre-prohibition. However, there's still some impacts. We're still not there. There is still some negative impacts from alcohol on our communities and our neighborhoods. And as we heard earlier, one of the number one issues is underage drinking. It's a nationwide epidemic across the nation. Oregon is not alone. It was so that the U.S. Surgeon General sent out a call to action to all states to do something about underage drinking and address it. And that instigated the Governor Kulongowski's formation of the Underage Drinking Task Force that has addressed and looked at what we can do in our state to address this serious issue. As you saw before, you know, our increase in 8th graders and 11th graders is increasing dramatically, and it went down a downturn for a while, and it's now upward trend, so we're trying to address that. I think there's too many lives, there's too many people affected by underage drinking. When I get calls from parents, and I get these on a regular basis, and ask me, why and what can I do when their son or daughter had been drinking or got their alcohol from a licensed establishment? And it's a very tough time to try to address that because it's very hard to go back and try to figure out who is responsible for that. Overservice is another big, huge issue we still have. In 2004, there was over 24,500 some DUI arrests. And as we all know, the ones that are arrested are just the tip of the iceberg of those who are driving under the influence of alcohol in our state. There was 184 deaths, fatalities, caused by drunken drivers, and alcohol is a primary factor in that. That's 184 deaths that were senseless that didn't need to happen. And so we're really trying to address that and trying to figure out what the Liquor Commission can do. We've also realized 40% increase in our licensees in over the past decade, and our staff has pretty much stayed stagnant in that level. And as you heard, we have 12,000 active licenses. Of those 12,000, there's 9,800 retail licensed premises. I have 32 inspectors, FTEs, that are responsible for overseeing 9,800 licensed premises, and it's an overwhelming task for them to try to do that. We recognize, as a Liquor Commission, we can't solve the whole issue of underage drinking in the state of Oregon. It's a collaborative agreement, and we have been working in partnerships with law enforcement and Department of Human Services and Oregon Partnership and a variety of different people to try to address this issue. But we need, basically, more additional staff in order to really be effective. And I believe if we can add more additional staff, we can be a little more proactive. Deal and be able to have more time to spend with our licensees, to be able to help them understand the laws and not just dropping in very quickly, dropping out, or just trying to find them doing something wrong, as we really would like to be more proactive. And so this package basically addresses adding some additional inspectors across the state. We are proposing to open a new office in Ontario with this package. That far eastern area of Oregon has been greatly underserved by us. The closest office is Pendleton, which is about 164 miles away, and to get over there is just almost impossible on a regular basis. So we're proposing to open an office in the Ontario area. We're proposing to add another inspector in the Eugene area. Add another one in Salem and two in the Portland area, because that's where about half of our licensed premises are located in the greater metropolitan area. I'd be happy to answer any questions on this policy option.
Representative Cormier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm somewhat confused about how the inspectors will decrease the number of teenagers drinking, especially 8th and 11th graders.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I think the area that we can have impact at OLCC is making sure they're not getting it from licensed premises.
Right, but one might assume that 8th graders would not be buying this alcohol from licensed premises.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I don't have any statistics to tell you where they're getting it. Most likely not. but you would be surprised of the ability of the youth to get. I mean, we've used very young-looking decoys, and they have been able to buy alcohol without a problem in certain areas. So it's probably not the primary place that eighth graders get their alcohol, but it's an area that we have responsibility to make sure they can't get it from licensed premises.
Maybe this is just a comment to you or to the panel here, but I certainly don't disagree with your wanting more people to follow up on studying these licensed premises. But on the other hand, I don't think it really addresses the huge problems that Representative was mentioning a minute ago about the number of children who are underage drinking that is increasing. And I think that it behooves all of us, and certainly the Commission, to be looking at that in a more holistic way rather than just trying to stop the sale to underage drinkers.
Madam Chair, Representative Toomey, we agree with you 100%. One of the things we have started talking about, of course it hasn't gone very far at this point, is possibly an education department within the Commission. We certainly do partner with as many outside agencies, Oregon Partnership, for instance. We work as closely with them as possible. So we do look beyond our own walls wherever possible to help solve these problems. But we have looked at the possibility of an education group.
Senator Verger.
I'm not sure what adding these people going to do to underage drinking. You've got to convince me that there is a direct result in this. If we need education, then maybe we should take that money and put it into education. People are your most expensive element in your budget, always, in any budget. So when you add five people, you're adding benefits, you're adding all kinds of cost, and I'm just not sure of how that's going to solve this problem.
Mr. Farrell, I'm not going to ask you to respond now. We've only got 15 minutes. I want to make it through the rest of these, but I think you've heard from two members of this panel. You got an issue. You need some convincing done here. You want to do package 203?
Okay. Package 203 is requesting 2.5 FTE to address licensing and administrative process, workload, and customer service. Licensing helps support our hospitality industry and our tourism. It helps sustain jobs and protect the public safety, making sure people are qualified. However, we've seen an increase, as we've said before, of 41% of our liquor licenses, and I share, and that we've also seen an increase in our service permits over the last 10 years. We used to have about 30% increase. We have tried many ways to make our licensing process as efficient as possible. One of the key ways we've been doing is we're working on this legislative session, or this biennium, is a new information technology system that will hopefully consolidate all of our licensing enforcement and all the administrative actions, and so we have one database. However, we have tried to simplify our rules. We've tried to simplify our paperwork. We've taken away reports and really trying to get down to what we really need to do. We've consolidated licenses. We used to have 37 types of licenses. We're down to around 12. We're trying to make our application accessible on our web page. But with all this, the sheer volume of the increase in our licenses as the growth has happened has overwhelmed the staff. And this is specifically really in Portland. The Portland growth has been phenomenal, and they have seven licensed investigators who handle the greater Portland area, and it's been overwhelming. In 2001, the average number of days in the metro area to issue a license was 92 days. In 2005, it extended to about 115 days. So despite all of our actions of trying to simplify this process, we're still lagging behind just the sheer volume and the resource issue and licensing. And with licensing also comes, and with all the actions of reducing rules and changing rules and administrative actions, has put a workload on our rules coordinator and also our contested staff. And so they are asking for additional resources and the half FTE on that. Any questions on this one?
Keep going.
Okay. Package 304 is basically continuing improving our infrastructure that we are working on this biennium. This biennium, we're going to be able to finish our project, and we'll be able to have people renew their licenses on electronically instead of having to send in or come into the office. We're going to try to allow, with this next one, is to allow the initial annual license to be submitted to us electronically. We also are asking to, we're going to interface the service education component. So we have one integrated system that has all of the regulatory functions into one database system. So this package is to try to finish our electronic process and our IT infrastructure.
Senator Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What are the approximate ongoing costs of this program? I understand that the package that is recommended here is a one-time cost and to finish the current transition.
Madam Chair, Senator Edwards, yes, this is a one-time finish.
Okay.
Hello? Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm going to go ahead and do package number 107, continue meeting consumer demand. Also, I'm going to do the remove safety hazard package 313, then I'll turn it over to Michael O'Connor to do the rest. Continue meeting consumer demand, quite simply, growth has been better than expected. It continues to be great. The opportunities for sales are there. But we have to support those sales. We have to support those sales in terms of having the people to do what we need them to do. We are looking for 9 permanent FTEs. That will include making permanent 6 limited duration personnel that we have in the distribution center now. So it's not 9 brand new. We already have 6 there that were granted by the e-board. This includes additional monies for bank card fees as well as associated and general additional liquor to cover additional liquor sales. We anticipate with this package we can go ahead and meet the $852 million with regards to our projection as far as revenue in terms of sales. Sales trends have been very strong. Basically, the industry is...
For the benefit of the panel, because I was confused and I just want to clarify this, the e-board extended you limited duration positions, and you're now coming in to make those permanent positions.
I'm sure that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
Basically, the distilled spirits industry has reinvented itself. The market has continued to grow. What I've heard from the industry is they're looking about 10 years in terms of a growth cycle. We're maybe a couple years into that cycle, but it continues to be very strong. They have brought a lot of new products on. There's a lot more marketing effort they're putting into it. We expect, with regards to cultural and demographic shifts, to keep on buying up. We've sold products as expensive as almost $7,000 for one bottle of cognac. The market is just shifting up, and there's great opportunities for the state to, what I believe, meet customer demand. We're not out there creating customer demand. That's what the industry does. We're there to see that we meet it in an effective and efficient way. And with this program, with this package, I mean, we will be able to continue that. And it'll shoot us up from about 4.2 million cases to 5.4 million within the biennium. So unless there's some questions, that's all I have for this panel.
Senator Whitson.
Chair Johnson, on your little package here, it says it includes paying almost $1.1 million in bank card fees associated with generating additional liquor sales. Why is that lined out? Isn't, you know, you would expect that the bank card fee would just be part of the expanded liquor sale?
Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, bank card fees are a variable cost of doing business. There's a direct relationship with the amount of sales that are generated, the amount of revenue that's generated, and whether how much bank card fees we pay. And those bank card fees are really dependent upon the individual consumer. When you walk into one of the liquor stores, it's your choice at that particular point in time whether to pay cash, use credit card, use a debit card. But when you choose to use a debit card or a credit card, that's a direct cost to the Liquor Control Commission for the fees associated with that bank card fee.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt.
Senator Whitsitt doesn't look like that was completely responsive.
Well, I was going to ask a follow-up question. Do you mean it should be just a cost of doing business, Senator? Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, actually, we have oftentimes
Well, actually, if I may, Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, last biennium, through legislative action, it was changed from a non-limited amount to a limited amount. It was actually then became part of our administrative budget. It has indeed in prior biennium been a non-limited amount.
I'll have Senator Whitson.
Yeah, thank you. Then, in generally, in a retail situation like that, you're going to have cash, you're going to have checks, you're going to have a bank account, your bank cards, your debit cards, and of course, cash is usually good. You would weigh off your bank card and debit card against the possibility of taking bad checks. So, that seems like within any retail operation, that's just part of doing business. And I'm having, maybe we could talk about this later, but I'm having trouble getting my hands around why we would call out that one expense as not part of doing business.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Wilson, we'll revisit that later on. We'll get some more information for you.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions about the meeting consumer demand, I'll go right into you.
Whoops, Representative Hanna, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, but can you explain to me what the bottleneck is that's created by not getting these nine positions? You lose a million cases. What happens? Because this has nothing to do with the new warehouse, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that's correct. Where it makes a difference is, in the package, we have district managers. We have district manager in there. We are looking to open up additional stores. At this point, I believe my numbers are correct. Each manager we have now currently oversees 50 to 60 stores. In order to open up new stores, we need to have another district manager. When we open up new stores, that yields additional sales that we would not be getting probably otherwise. Also, the additional people that are not there within the distribution center will go ahead and affect the number of cases that we can push through the distribution center in terms of receiving and shipping out.
Hello.
Oh.
So how many of these folks are in the warehouse and how many are the district manager type of the nine?
Pardon me? There's just one. Right. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, there's one district manager and there is one administrative assistant and the rest are in the warehouse.
That responsive, Representative? Okay. You got 6 minutes.
Pretty quickly, remove safety hazard. Basically, we have a water tower that was decommissioned in 1987. It's been sitting there. It's been rusting, and we want to take it down. The risk management has given us notice that it is a good idea to do so. The approximate cost is $150,000. That's what we're asking for in the package, and that will take care of a possible falling tower that could create problems or injury.
You own it.
Okay. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, if I may, I'll address package 110, maintain equity of store operating expenses fund. This package works in conjunction with package number 107 to ensure that there's adequate limitation to pay liquor agents compensation at an average of 8.88% of sales. The store operating expense fund is used to compensate liquor agents for the sale of OLCC-owned distilled spirits. From these funds, the agents pay for the operations of their stores, their staff salaries, and the net income for the take-home is their take-home pay. Package 107's resources enable the Commission to achieve its projected sales of $852.3 million, an increase of $170 million from the essential budget level. The increase in compensation in Package 110 will guarantee that if liquor agents are able to achieve the sales projection of $852 million, that there will be adequate limitation available to meet the legislatively mandated payout of an average of 8.88% of sales. Please note that the agent's compensation is a variable expense of doing business, and if actual sales are less than projected, only enough limitation will be used to pay an average of 8.88% of sales.
And, colleagues, it begs the policy question that will probably not be decided in this venue necessarily is whether the 8.88 stays. Or whether that number's changed. You're calculating your $15,256,000 at 8.88.
That's correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, Package 503, Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention Treatment, provides for the transfer of 2% of gross liquor proceeds for alcohol and drug prevention treatment. This proposal by the governor is before the legislature of Senate Bill 184.
Based on the governor's recommended budget, the commission expects the distribution to be $17 million in 2007-09 biennium. OLCC statutes require that at the end of each month, all net revenue is to be distributed to specific recipients. The commission collects all the revenue from its different sources each month and accumulates the funds in its state treasury account. Included in your presentation materials is a schematic that shows the distribution and the recipients of OLCC revenue amounts. OLCC expects distribution of revenues based on the governor's recommended budget to total $336.3 million in the next biennium. The governor's proposal will provide $17 million for drug and alcohol abuse prevention, and beer and wine tax collections will provide another $15.2 million to the Addictions and Mental Health Division. The general fund will receive $170 million. Oregon cities will receive $103.2 million, including the revenue-sharing amounts, and Oregon counties will receive $30.4 million.
I'm going to ask you to put those in writing unless they're somewhere in this book that I have missed.
I'll get it for you.
So that we have a clear idea of where all of these dedicated streams are. Senator Verger, then Senator George.
Madam Chair, do we have a clear understanding, not of the way the money is distributed as it goes out, but as the money goes into OLCC, exactly how that operation works? Isn't there something in my memory about they only pay for it once it leaves the distribution center? And I mean, it's not just typical of what I think of in a business.
Madam Chair, Senator Verger, what you remember was the term bailment. When we have product that's in our warehouse or distribution center, we do not take possession in terms of paying for that until the day that we ship it out. That's correct.
Senator George.
Thanks. Could you guys provide for us as best you can? I've been reading through the package here, and I see that for counties, for example, that we pay them amount of money that's 4 to 10 times below what they're actually spending to deal with alcohol, a related issue. Could you provide for us the total amount that you would estimate of all the fatalities, all the DUIs statewide, and then the amount of people that we have in federal, in state prison, what that's costing us, and if there is any estimate of what this is costing local government? I'd like to see that, because I didn't realize the problem was quite this large, even though I came from a local budget committee and knew it was a major issue. But any numbers that you guys could provide for us, total number of fatalities on the highway, the total amount of child abuse, the total amount of everything related to alcohol use.
Senator George, I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair. I think that the magnitude of that research request could be overwhelming.
But the best we can do.
I have a meeting later with Director Farrow, and I will try to winnow down how that request can be researched. I also want to leave open the door for local government to come in here and provide public testimony about it, but I just am worried about the magnitude of the research that you've asked for. Representative Hanna, Representative Shields, and then we're winding up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want a brief description of the difference between the amount remaining for distribution. I'm new to this budget, but what is the 20% Oregon cities and 14% city revenue sharing? Can you describe the difference and how that works?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, the Liquor Control Commission forwards the 14% of city revenue sharing on a monthly basis to DAFs, who accumulates it with other revenue sharing amounts and distributes that based on their formulas. The actual amount for Oregon cities, the 20%, is the amount that we actually distribute based on a per capita basis to the cities ourselves.
Responsive? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In package number 503, I want to make sure I understand. Prevention, early intervention, and treatment services, what percentage of the 17-plus million would go to each?
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, I don't have that information. We'll see. We'll get it for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Here are the ground rules for tomorrow. We've rushed OLCC through this so fast that there may be some things that Director Farrow and his team would want to amplify or respond to, given the plethora of questions that you were asked. So it's my intention to leave them half an hour to finish up their presentation and then to have the opportunity for some public testimony. As a courtesy to the chair, I would like those wishing to testify to give me some advance notice so we can figure out how to allocate time. The more of you there are, the less time you have to channel your message. So you might want to go out in the hall and fight among yourselves how you're going to divvy up an hour. With that, any concluding comments from the panel? We stand adjourned without objection.